Everyone awake and ready? Great. Let us pray together, O Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on a throne of my consciousness.
Cross and the Lotus Journal out, so please take one on your way out. Many different people tell me how when they get the journal, they want to take it and have a special time in order to read it, and some keep it by their nightstand and read it each night before they go to sleep. So it's wonderful that these words can go out and that they can help uplift and inspire people. From my dear friends, recently I had an encounter with death. Each time I have been with a body whose life has fled away, it has had a significant effect on me. I remember my grandfather's body lying in a casket. Someone whispered that he looked like he was taking a nap. I had seen my grandfather napping before, and I was keenly aware that he did not look like a napper. There was the obvious fact that he was not breathing, his skin was lacking normal pallor, yet there was something more. His life was gone. There was a definite absence of spirit. I was in my teens, but I knew something precious and intangibly tangible was no longer there. A few weeks ago, Carla's mom left the body. We found her in her bed. Her soul had moved on, her body now an empty shell. Death is a constant reminder and campaigner to discover the changeless reality where rust and moth do not corrupt. Many people may encounter death in a profound way that shakes their basic assumptions about what is real and lasting. But then the illusion that they will live on and on resurrects itself again, and they once again settle into complacency. There are blessed few who, upon witnessing death, are sufficiently disturbed that it provokes them into a quest for the ultimate verities, to answer the questions, who am I? What is the true purpose of my life? And is death a finality from which we never awaken? The ancient tale of Siddhartha Gautama tells us about three disturbing encounters that were the genesis for his search for sacred nirvana. Siddhartha was a passenger on a chariot traveling over his extensive properties. He saw a man on the side of the road, covered in sores, moaning in pain. Siddhartha asked the driver to stop. Having been kept ignorant of sickness all of his life, he asked the driver what was wrong with this man. When he learned the man was sick, he asked if kings also got sick. He was told everyone gets sick at some time or another in life. The scene was later repeated with a man in advanced old age, and finally he encountered a dead man. He had not seen these three maladies, having been carefully screened from illness, old age, and death, death being the final reality, even for kings. This was the beginning of the awakening of Siddhartha, who became the Buddha, the Awakened One. It is a strange thing that a part of our mind seems to screen out sickness, old age, and death as ultimate realities, just as Siddhartha was unaware of them when he lived over 2,500 years ago. At some point, an event breaks through, and sickness, old age, and death are really encountered in a way that shakes us from our denial. When Siddhartha had these encounters, it made him question the very purpose of life. If everything ends with death, then what is this life really all about? While death is a fact that is much a part of your life as disease and old age, still it often comes as a shock when one of these three realities breaks through to your mind. Siddhartha used these events to launch him into a quest for truth. Any event in life can be used as a propellant for deepening realization, or it can shake your faith and take you into darkness. It all depends on your choice you make in response to a crisis. Some may choose to bravely get through grief and go on with little change. Some may seek to soothe the pain with alcohol, drugs, or work. A few may follow the Buddha's lofty example, exhibiting an unquenchable desire to know the truth. My own relationship with those who have died and the partings have significantly changed through the years. I remember an experience I had at my grandmother's funeral when I was but a few years on the path. The Methodist minister had not met my grandmother. She is not a churchgoer, and he was in the unenviable position of speaking publicly about a woman he had never met. He announced that he had once been an economics teacher and went on to give a dissertation on the economic realities of the early settlers of the valley where my grandmother had lived. Inwardly, I was feeling my grandmother as a living consciousness. I had been meditating and practicing Kriya for a few years at the time, and my attunement had grown a little. While I listened to this impersonal monologue that had little to do with my grandmother, I thought this man could turn grief into boredom faster than anyone could believe. With that thought, I felt my grandmother's laughter. I too suddenly wanted to laugh. I had to hide my smile during the solemn service. It was a brief encounter, but one that made me know that death of the body had no final claim on the soul. During the succeeding years, I have found more and more openings at death's door. I do not say this lightly, nor does it come with any drama. When I spent a year in silence and seclusion at Cloud Mountain, I became established in an inward awareness of deep spiritual connection with those not physically present. During this year, a profound knowing came to me about anyone my mind became focused upon. A knowing, a communing, a certainty that the individual and I were connected and something sacred passed between us through the bond. It did not make any difference if the person was living in a body or dead. What we call death changed in meaning, for I felt no separation from anyone who had passed from the body. With this awareness, fear passed from me in regards to death. In addition, I came to know that being focused on gaining or losing material things, even health and mental acuity, were no longer absolutes needed for happiness. I felt, rather I knew, that when the soul is released from the body, all such concerns pass with the body. What the individual is left with are those invisible virtues that are built over a lifetime: character, an attitude of service, love, truthfulness, kindness, generosity, etc. In stark contrast, the things we own or covet, status in the world, what the body looks like, and so many preoccupations of the mind while living on this world stage, pass into a distant and meaningless memories. When we leave the body behind, we also leave so much of the ignorance that is associated with the body. Generally speaking, at the time of death, we pass into the astral realm, and there we enjoy the finer vibrations associated with a higher life. The soul understands now, as perhaps it never understood in the material world, the deeper nature of spiritual attunement and the beauty of the inner life. This is not to say that one is automatically a realized soul. However, for a soul determined not to live in darkness, a refined understanding that is more closely attuned to the divine now becomes self-evident. Death has much to teach us if we would become its willing students even while living. We would learn to focus on what is really important in life, to be lifelong learners, to love and allow ourselves to be loved in return, to be generous, to know that we have come to accomplish certain tasks and to strive to accomplish them, and most of all, to grow in spiritual consciousness. It is an interesting thing that moving into the astral realms, what most people would associate with being in heaven, is not an end of our journey. There are states of inner spiritual attunement that evade the notice of astral citizens. There is much, much more to experience and realize. And from John 14:2, "In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you." The wonderful thing is this. We do not need to wait until we die before we can have access to these rarefied states of consciousness. That is what meditation is really for. We can know the highest states far beyond the astral heavens. There is no artificial limit to what you may accomplish even while you are here in the physical body. In fact, as the song says, "If I can do it here, I can do it anywhere." This is the truth. You can pass beyond this body, the astral realm, even the fine causal realm, and go directly into the absolute freedom of spirit. This is the great truth that the Buddha, Jesus, Krishna, and all the great avatars and prophets have come to make known. Only an uncomprehending world invents reasons why you cannot realize God, even going to extremes by persecuting those who say what should be a self-evident truth. The real death spoken of in the scriptures is not death of the body. It is a death of the idea of separation. Separation from the great spiritual reality that is holding you in its hands, even now. Reach out your hand and you will feel the hand of the infinite. With loving pronouns, David. As I said in the writing, it is an interesting thing each time that I have encountered a body whose life has fled. I remember reaching down for Carla's mom, and her body was cold. That's the first thing, perhaps, that is a confirmation, and frozen in place as if she was reaching for her next breath while she is lying in her bed. And it comes as somewhat of a shock to the system because somehow we're never quite prepared for this event when it comes. And in truth, there is little preparation, little indications or signs that she is getting ready to leave the body when she did. The mind registers it, and yet sometimes does not comprehend what it sees and what it feels. As I said, there is such an absence of life in that moment. And it is clear that the life, the consciousness, the intelligence, the mind, the memories, they were all gone. And of course, the great question comes that if this is the finality of life, if this is what it all culminates in, is there anything else or is that it? Do we just simply become consumed back into the earth and dissolve back once again? It is interesting that there were generations within the Jewish religion in which there is no thought that there was any life after death, that the idea that what you did was visited on 10 generations after you, that your progeny is what carried on your life, and that there was a God, but there is no life after death. It's an interesting idea. How do we know any differently? And the only reason we can know is to go into the laboratory of our own souls, to have some direct experience that begins to confirm that there is something more. I have had such experiences to the point where it has convinced me all the way through that the death of this body is not the death of the soul, is not the death of the life and the intelligence and the memories that that individual incorporated. There are some who argue that those who believe in such things are only trying to fool themselves. They just try to comfort themselves that there's something more after the death of this body, and that in truth we don't know. But the truth is, you can know. Jesus demonstrated this when he talked about it. He talked about life after death in this body, even before he left the body. There are many masters, there are many saints, there are many sages, there are many mystics who have had revelations, and many of us have had direct experience of this ourselves. And yet, unless we go further and just go beyond an experience or two which may convince us that there is life after death, we have to take it further, or we will remain with the fear of death somewhere inside of us. Even then, there is a certain fear that's registered within the body. When you think about it, the whole body is geared toward survival. And whether it is through fighting off of a disease or running away from a problem or fighting your way through a problem, the body wants to survive. It's its instinct. It's natural. Even when Lari Mahasya was told by Swami Sri Yukteswarji a message that came from Babaji that told him that his life energy was being used up and he was soon to leave, he shuddered through his entire body. The body reacted. But immediately he focused his concentration at the ajna and merged himself into his spiritual consciousness, and he rose above that initial repulsion. Sri Yukteswar said, it is like the bird who has been held in a cage for so long. The door of that cage is opened up, but the bird hesitates going towards freedom, going through the door, because it is so long accustomed to its cage. It's what's familiar. And the body reacts to that. There's a very fascinating story of Lari Mahasya. He was holding a Gita class. Someone was reading from the Bhagavad Gita, and then Lari Mahasya would make some commentary of the inner meaning of these words from the Gita. His wife sent down word that his daughter, she was 16 years old at the time, was very ill. Lari Mahasya sent back a message and said, here, take this leaf. It was from a common plant that was near him. Take this leaf, make a tea out of it, and give it to our daughter, and she will recover. There are many relatives standing about, and she felt embarrassed to make a tea out of this and to do such a thing. It was not a common practice. So she didn't do it. In the next little while, the daughter left the body. Upstairs, where the relatives were gathered, there became a loud wailing noise, the crying and suffering of those in separation from this young girl. Lari Mahasya and the group were doing their Gita study, and whoever was reading the Gita stopped for a bit as he heard these cries come out from above. Lari Mahasya said, go ahead, keep your reading. He did for a little bit, but then he couldn't continue after a bit. And so he said, all right, we'll stop the class for now. He appeared to be unaffected by what had occurred at the time. And if you were looking from the outside, you might say, is he hard-hearted? Has he no connection, no compassion, no empathy for the death of his own daughter? But the truth is that he was not confined to his bodily consciousness, and that he was with his daughter as she merged and went into the astral realms, and he accompanied her in that way. Now, when you have that experience and you feel the freedom that her soul felt at that time, you saw her entering into the light and preparing herself to enter into a new life, then where is the grief? You can have some feeling of loss that you won't see that person in the same way, you won't have physical contact with them, that they've gone in that sense. But when you're fully aware that they have merged and they've gone beyond, and you feel connected with that life form, with that intelligence, with the person that she had been, and more than that, the soul that she is, that she may not have fully comprehended even while she was living, now she lives on. And so where is the grief in that? Where is the loss, you see? And this is how life is intended to be lived. It doesn't mean that you don't suffer any loss at all. If you have a friend, and that friend decides to move across to a different part of the world, and you don't have the kind of day-to-day contact with that one, and you will miss them. Perhaps you can phone them. Perhaps you can see them from time to time, but you don't have the constant contact that you're used to. You will miss that kind of interaction. But you don't grieve for that one, usually, in the same way that you would grieve for one who has left the body, and yet there is really no difference. That one has just simply left the location that they were at in the human body, and they have now merged themselves into a higher consciousness. The fact is, what we probably really grieve for is we grieve for ourselves, that we've been left behind, that we do not have the eyes to see or the ears to hear that consciousness. And those who are in the astral realms, generally speaking, are very cognizant of us. If we focus our attention upon them, then most often they can see and hear and feel us. Now, the astral realms are not all of one sort. There are a dark region in the astral realms, those who have dedicated themselves to living a life that is headed towards darkness. They don't want anything to do with the light. They don't want to have anything to do with truth. They live in shadows, and they live in a shadow world, and they don't like the light. They're repulsed by it. Those souls will not go into the higher astral realms. Those souls will go into a dark, drenched area. And there they will carry on their kind of psychic warfare that they're so used to upon this material plane. They don't get the benefit of a higher understanding, of a higher connection with the soul, but rather they dwell in these regions where they just carry on the same patterns they always have. And when they're reborn back into a material body, they carry with them those same tendencies. But most people are not of that type. Most people try to live a good life overall. They may make mistakes, they might fall short of the goal, but they're not totally repulsed by the light. They have a conscience. They try to do the right thing. And as a result of that, when they die, they enter and merge into a realm of light. The astral realms are wonderful, really. There you don't have the same kind of physical encumbrances that we do here. There the body can dissolve into energy. It can travel by light, faster than light, through thought. It can materialize things, it can create great beauty, and is surrounded by great beauty. And so it's a wonderful place, a wonderful place. And yet, even in those astral realms, we can become really so preoccupied with the beauty of the place, with the freedom, with the kind of joy that we have there, that we don't seek out anything higher. But there are higher realms. For those who enter into the causal realms, they enter into a much greater freedom, much vaster, more closely attuned to the divine consciousness. And for them, the astral body would feel as heavy and confining as for an astral being, the physical body would feel like a heavy lead overcoat for them and would restrict their freedom from travel, from thought, from creation. And so those who are in the causal realms feel even the greater freedom, closer attunement to the light. There is only a thin veil between the causal and what is beyond. Ramakrishna once talked about having achieved what he had in a spiritual sense. And he was lifted up one time and he saw 9 great beings in the causal realm. And he felt an attraction to one of them and he asked him, "Would you come down and help me in this physical incarnation?" And that causal being agreed to do so and ascended. And when he met him, when Ramakrishna met him, he was a young man going to university, and he eventually became Swami Vivekananda. And that great being was here to help all humanity because he came to the West. He was a forerunner of Master coming to the West, and he made a great influence on people and on events. And so these are great beings that reside in this causal realm. But even those who reside in the causal realms, there is a thin veil that takes them into pure spiritual attainment. And in that, there is no encumbrance of form. There is no time. There is no space. There is no idea of separation whatsoever. In spiritual consciousness, you attain that complete emancipation that the soul and the heart so much yearns for. We all yearn for it unconsciously. But there are those who strive to find it in other ways. We see it all the time. Whether it is by finding accomplishment in this world or finding it in dark ways, such as through drugs, through alcohol, through other means, everyone is seeking out after real happiness, real bliss. But there are few who find it. Today we live in a world that seems dedicated towards finding emancipation through this physical body and through the senses. Through the physical sciences, we try to prolong the life and the health of this body. Nothing wrong with that unless all of our eggs are in that basket. Because no matter how perfected physical science becomes, we will one day leave this body. And so death is the final prompter towards divine consciousness, because we have to seek something beyond the beyond in order to really gain the true happiness and freedom that we are searching for. It's a sad thing today, and it's a sad commentary. There's a big push right now for medical marijuana laws, and they have that in Oregon. And I'm told that in a small town in Ashland there are over 1,000 who are able to prescribe for medical marijuana, or being prescribed medical marijuana. And they are supplying it to all the children there. And so there are young teens, and it's all easily available. And if you look on certain websites and so on, it is all talked about in comparison to alcohol and how much better it is and so on and so forth. But who would argue that for a developing mind and a body, that infusion of drugs in this way is a good thing for them? It retards your spiritual progress because you don't continue to grow mentally, emotionally, in all other ways. Even as an alcoholic or anybody else who consumes any kind of drugs, these things are a retardant to our progress. I have done these things. I know about them. I know what they can do for you and what they cannot do for you. And I know that they cannot produce a state of realization. They do not give you the joy, the peace, and the happiness that we really seek. They give you temporary relief. And it's a fool's errand, really. It's a dead end to go down that direction. And once you do, it becomes very enticing. It draws you to it. These things are not neutral. We'd like to think that we could just do whatever it is we want to do, and when we choose to do something differently, we just change course. But how often do we see people who take up smoking, people who take up drinking, people who take up drugs? They come to a point where they'd like to quit. And they seek to quit, but they don't do it. As W.C. Field says, it's easy to quit. I must have done it 1,000 times. It doesn't come easy. Yes, you can quit, but can you stay quit? That is the real issue. And there are many people who take up these habits, and then they become imprisoned by the habits themselves. They promise freedom. They promise joy. They promise all the things that we seek to have. But what really produces it? You see, we have to really analyze this life in order to understand it. If we're not willing to take a look at ourselves and see what the results are of the things that we do, then we will not grow. There is an interesting book by Scott Peck. It was called People of the Lie. Scott Peck was a psychologist interested in the spiritual realm. And People of the Lie, he was investigating the notion of evil. And his basic premise was that those people who do not have the courage to face themselves and to make the changes that are required to evolve, to be better beings, that they ultimately end up committing evil because of their cowardice, their spiritual cowardice. They will not grow, and they take that out on themselves and everybody around them. And we see cases of this where there is massive projection. You project everything onto everybody else. And if the world just wasn't so, then I wouldn't be so angry. And if I wasn't so angry, I wouldn't beat people up or I wouldn't harm people. They just did what I told them to do. And all sorts of justifications that come along the way. Unless we're willing to have the courage and the ability to face ourselves and to begin to really make the changes that count, then we are not spiritually growing, and there is no neutral ground, not really. We're constantly creating. We're constantly creating with our thoughts, with our actions, with our words. They go out from us, and they produce a very definite effect. And we would like to think, and many people like to think, that what they do doesn't matter. They become very angry at leaders and other people who have accomplished things. They're easy targets. But ask them to take some little account for themselves and nothing doing. Oh, what I do doesn't count because I'm just a peon and I'm not up in the echelons like these others, these evil people. Yet we all count. Everybody counts. There is nobody that does not count. You see this with the great lives of the avatars and great spiritual masters. Jesus didn't see anybody as a throwaway person. They brought to him that poor woman who was caught in adultery, and they are going to stone her to death right there in front of God and everyone. And they ask him what to do. What was the right thing to do? And he said, those of you without sin, cast the first stone. Meanwhile, he was writing down in the sand all the different sins that each one of the people there holding rocks had committed. And they looked at what he was writing. And they looked at the woman, and he had force, he had power in what he was doing, and so they examined themselves. And they realized that there was no one there standing without sin. They dropped the rocks and they walked away. And when Jesus approached her, he said, "Where are your accusers?" And she looked around and she saw all had left. And he said something important. He said, "Go out and sin no more. Don't make the errors that you have been making. Live up to the higher light within yourself. Don't give in to temptations. Go out and sin no more. They do not condemn you, neither do I." In your heart, you should always want the best for everybody that you meet, everybody that you interact with. You know, sometimes family members and those who are closest to us are the ones who are hardest to forgive. Why is this? It's because we have the highest expectations for them. A stranger we have very little expectation of, but somebody who's in the family or a good friend, We have high expectations, and if they don't do exactly what it is we think they should do, then we find it hard to forgive. But look at the example of Jesus in this case. I forgive thee. To let go, not just in your mind, not just to say the words, but to emotionally, to energetically let go. Let go of your anger. Let go of your frustration. Let go of your hatred. And free yourself. You will find that that anger, that resentment, that lack of forgiveness has been holding you, has been binding you, and that you have been the worst recipient of the energy that you have put forward. When you put forward love, you cannot always love the personality, because somebody sometimes does not always have a lovable personality. It's not that. You don't focus on the personality. Which of us, though, would have been considered a lost cause at some point in this life or in some other? God revealed to me a life in which I led a pretty rough life. I was a warrior. I was responsible for the death and mutilation of many, many people in the rampages that I was involved with. I gained a great amount of political power in where I was, but you know, I was completely empty. I was sad. I was morose. I carried out my duties, but there was no joy. I had the kind of worldly power that I had sought, and it produced no satisfaction for me whatsoever. And that was a turning point for me, because when I had left the body, as God showed me, I rose up above it. I met the Christ in spirit. And that light, that wonderful intelligence, that strength, you see, I admired strength. And I felt the spiritual power and strength within that being. But I felt more than that. I felt the intelligence. I felt the love. I felt the light. I felt the wisdom. And as I reviewed my life, I saw the mistakes that I had made. I regretted the things that I had done. And I vowed to myself at that point that I wanted to become like this great being of light who sat next to me. Now, as Mother explained, that great being of light that appears to sit next to us is actually the Christ within our own selves. It is our own inborn nature that is perfect and pure and full of light and wisdom and love. And so we are judged by no man. We simply judge ourselves, and we judge what is true, what is right, what is uplifting, what is lovely. And death brings us this gift. It was a great gift to me. And it was a turnaround in my life. I wanted to change my life from that point forward. But it wasn't easy, you see. I had to go through many lives where I faced all the things that I had done in my outward journey from God. And some of those lives were very difficult. They were hard to endure. And when you look at it only through the snapshot of that particular life, and some of them were short lives, you would say that's unfair. How could God be fair to such a soul when you look at it only within the context of that life? But when you search the roots and go deep within that soul, you see there is a lawful causative chain, the law of cause and effect, and it takes you further and further back until you realize and understand where these things come from, and then you see a perfect kind of justice. But it is not just punishment. It should not be understood that what we experience in this life and what we consider negative things is punishment. Because through those experiences, then, you see, through all the things that I experienced in those different lives after that fact, I was now on the receiving end of what I had dished out. And now I couldn't go against somebody else. I couldn't punish somebody else. I couldn't hurt somebody else without seeing myself within that person. So it taught me compassion, you see. And this is the real purpose for the law of cause and effect. That whatever we do comes back to you. That is true. But it is not as punishment. It is to teach you that whatever you do, you cannot do but to yourself. And when we realize this, we realize we cannot gain from somebody else's suffering. We can only gain when we bring in more light, when we bring in more love, when we bring in more joy. We stand as beacons of light if we're truly living as we should live. And when we stand as a beacon of light, we can change ourselves. And we can help to change this world. And God knows this world needs changing. It needs attunement to the greater spiritual truths. It needs to seek out what is for the highest good of everybody concerned. Not just for a few, not just for me, not just for my family, not just this circle. But what is the good, highest good for everybody concerned? Compassion, you see, goes part and parcel with the spiritual life. You cannot look out through these two eyes and not see yourself within every being, not see God within every being. Now, it doesn't excuse bad behavior, but you understand the deeper nature of the soul behind the delusion within that one who's acting in such a way that causes harm to others. And you can even have compassion and even love for such a one when you know them as the eternal soul, not for what they do, but for who they are. And so let us set about to purify the mind. Let us not seek death of the body, but death to the old self, death to the limitations, death to all those things that encumber us and keep us from soaring into spiritual heights. I cannot tell you strongly enough what you have within you, how each day you could soar into the spiritual realms of divine consciousness. Do you understand what is possible within you? Do you understand when you don't take the time to search deeper that you are denying yourself that experience? Why would you do this? When there is such greatness, such beauty, such love, such grandeur, why would you indeed? And it takes such small effort to turn your mind towards God, to love God, to serve God, to become one with Him. Let us let this be the death of the old life and the birth of a new. Please join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace. Bliss. Amen. you allow me, God just reminded me of a story I was going to read from Papa. I think is wonderful. So if you'll allow me an afterword. It's entitled Contentment. There is a time when discontent seized the souls of men in the world to such an extent that they unitedly raised a wail to the throne of God for relief. Every man dissatisfied with his own lot felt he would gladly exchange places with his neighbor. God heard their cry and appeared before them. All the aggrieved people assembled around him on a vast plain. God now said, O men, in response to your prayers, I have come here. I give each of you the power to throw down on this plain this particular disability or woe which is the cause of your discomfort and misery. At once, in hot haste, all the people divested themselves of their burdens of sorrow and flung them on the plain. The accumulated heap of woes formed a veritable mountain. Now, O men, exclaimed God, you may pick up from this heap any burden which you prefer in exchange for the one which you have given up. Immediately there is a furious scramble, and each man grabbed at the burden of woe belonging to his neighbor. The blind man exchanged his blindness for a broken leg, and vice versa. The barren woman became fruitful, and vice versa. So on and so forth. Thus, in a short time, the mountain of woes disappeared. All the people felt for the moment happy and relieved. God left them, and they returned to their homes. What happened the next day? Louder lamentations, 100 times more than what it was the day before, rose from the people. God again presented himself before them. Now all the people cried out, O Lord, give me back my own woe, for I cannot endure the pains of grief which I have taken in exchange. God granted their prayer, and they returned perfectly satisfied. Isn't that wonderful?